Welcome to John Hutton.
Thank you. Had a good lunch? And what a tremendous talk about all these aspects of Islam. I'm grateful for that. Thank you. Wherever he went. I have a friend who is a Muslim, and we get into some very interesting conversations. He's a very gentle man, but he believes many of the things that we just heard. So he's doing a good job describing exactly how they think. Let me ask you something. If you had a chance to speak to 5,000 people, what would you say? 5,000 people have come to hear you talk. And now's your chance to say the thing that you really care about the most. Many people, I think, many of my evangelical brothers and sisters would say, well, I would explain to them Genesis through Revelation. I would try and lay out for them the whole gospel. They would have to see that we are sinners, that we were born good. We were in Adam, but that we were sinners, and that we are in need of salvation, and that the only salvation would be found in the incarnation himself and his self-sacrifice on our behalf, and so on and so on, and lay out the entire gospel presentation. And many people have done that, and many good things have come from it. I'll tell you something interesting. Okay? Oh, it's not? Well, it's got a blank slide here. Is that what you're concerned about?
Okay.
If you do this, maybe you'll see it. There you go. Sure. Merci bien. All right. Anyway, if you had an opportunity to do this, what would you do? I'm curious, because what Jesus did was something quite different. Jesus had an opportunity to speak to 5,000 people, and you know what he did first, right? He fed them. And then he said, a sower went to sow some seed, and some of the seed fell on the path, and some seed fell in the rocks, and some in the weedy soil, and some on good soil. And the seed that fell on the rocks here, the birds came in and ate it up. And the seed that fell in the rocky soil grew up pretty quickly, but it had very shallow roots, and it died very for lack of moisture. And the seed that fell in among the weeds grew up quickly too, but it was choked out by those weeds, and it all died. But there were some that fell here in the good soil, and it bore 30, 60, 100 fold. And then you know what he said? The most remarkable thing of all. He said, bye. And he left. That was it. Now, if you read the story in Mark 4, it says after that that the disciples came after him later on and said, what does this mean? What are you talking about? We don't get it. And he said, And he kind of chided him a little. And he said, you can't just get the parable. If you don't understand what the parable means, how are you going to understand any parable? How are you going to understand the nature of the kingdom of God? And then he went on and explained it. He said, the seed is the word of God, and the seed that fell on the path was hard, like a hard heart. Before it could take root, Satan came in the form of birds and ate it all up, and it was gone. And the seed that fell here in the shallow soil, fell in among rocks and so on, its roots were so shallow, it didn't dig down deep, and the roots were so shallow they eventually were burned away, and they lost their faith. They lost it. The seed that fell in the weeds. The weeds represent the cares of this world, the cares and the worries of this world. And they choked out that seed, and it died. But the seed that fell in the good soil, that bore fruit, just like it should. Now, what I want to say is, I think it's interesting that, first of all, Jesus didn't lay the entire story out to everybody. It's an interesting sort of way of evangelism, isn't it? Why wouldn't he do that with 5,000 people? He seemed to think that they needed to come to him and find out what it meant. They aren't all going to get it. He makes a point of saying that. He said, I speak in parables because there's a prophecy to fulfill, a prophecy that says some people are going to hear, those who have ears to hear are going to hear, and those who don't, won't. And he seemed to be perfectly happy to allow them to be worked on by the Holy Spirit and have them come then to him and say, what does all this mean? What is this about? To you I'll give the secret, he said. To you I'll give the secret. Well, that means that, well, if you remember what I was saying at the end of the last session, that is that when God decides how to say something, that's part of what he's trying to say. That when he speaks, the way he says it is also a significant portion of what he's trying to say. And I think we ought to take that seriously. That is an art form. The parable is a kind of an art form. It's a way of taking something that is profound and difficult to get your head around and putting it in material form so that it can be grasped, so that it can be understood. Ultimately speaking, I think the model for the artist is the incarnation. Because the incarnation is exactly what I just said. The incarnation is the invisible God becoming visible, tangible, walking among us, with dirt under his fingernails, learning to be a carpenter, living, breathing, heart beating, all those things. In other words, there's a physical manifestation of God. And we should always be sort of shocked at that and delighted that he took that route. You know, no other religion has ever, in fact, I agree with our pastor, I think it was the pastor that said the other day, that Christianity isn't a religion. I'm with him there. I think that makes sense. It's a relationship with this God. But it's a relationship that's made possible by way of this embodiment, by way of this seeing by way of the physical, you see? The physical world for the Christian is a good thing. Edith Schaefer used to say, yes, it's a fallen world, but there are leftover bits of beauty in it. It's a world full of shattered leftover beauty. And if we can see it, if we can find it, we will be delighted by it. Look for those things. I'm thinking too about Philippians 4, where you're told whatsoever is good and of good report and holy and uplifting and so on. Think on those things. When you think on those things, you find a resonance with that leftover beauty, that broken beauty in this world. What that verse doesn't mean is only allow yourself to look on things that are perfect. Because if you did that, then you wouldn't be watching me right now. There's nothing in this broken world that is perfect. Sin has damaged everything. However, within everything that you look at, within everything you consider, you should be thinking, what's good? What's noble? What's uplifting? What is holy? What is great? Graceful, what is beautiful, what is true, what is good. Think on those things. Let God deal with the rest of it. But if that's the case, that the material world that is good is being redeemed, that is, we're finding good in it as we go, then it's incumbent on the Christian to do the same thing. That is, to look at the world, to see what's good about it, and then draw it out and show it to each other. Take a look at this. Isn't this beautiful? Isn't this lovely? Isn't this worth spending time looking at? And I think to do that, you need two things. I've mentioned one already, and that is, do you remember what I mentioned in the beginning? What gift has God given us that makes it possible for us to see? The imagination. That's right. We are reluctant to take the imagination too far in our Christian mind because of the fact that it's been abused so often. But what I want to do is recognize the imagination as a gift from God and then train myself to use it the way God intended me to use it, which is a kind of baptized imagination, if you want to think of it that way, where you see things in the world, then you see relationships between them, and then you point those relationships out. Like you see, for example, marriage. You see a husband and a wife in a harmonious relationship, and through that, we're told in Paul, in Ephesians, we're able to see something of the nature of the relationship between Christ and His bride. Right? And then it reverses too. The more we know about the way Jesus treats His bride, the more we husbands know how to treat our wives. The more we know about how the bride is to respect and look up to her groom, Jesus, we are all the church, how we're supposed to relate to Him, the more we can see something about how wives might relate to husbands. And the reverse then, again, so it just goes back and forth and back and forth. So the better we know about God and the church, the better we can be husband and wife. The better we know about great marriages, the better we see into the depths of this wonderful mystery that Paul is talking about. This is one of many, right? But that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. Making a relationship between the physical world and the world that is invisible and difficult to grasp. Okay, so you need an imagination. That's the first thing. But there's a second thing I think you need. And that second thing is patience. Now, the reason I say that is that I think our day is as impatient a day as I've seen, as the world has seen. I think it's partly that we've been born into a kind of fast food, computerized, you know, TV, instant gratification kind of world. And to all you young people, I say, I'm sorry. I apologize. It's partly my generation that's handing that down to you. You've known, in some ways, you've known nothing else. And I'm sorry. I can't take all the credit or the blame, but I'll take some. But the idea that faster is inherently better is a lousy idea. The idea, I mean, there are times when it is, right? If you're running a 100-meter dash, 100-meter race, then faster is definitely better than slower. I'm with you there. But it's not always that way. And sometimes, and especially this way in art, if you want the bottom line, if you want the quick fix, if you want the executive summary of something, then you're not going to get what it is the artist is telling you. And when I say artist, I mean including God. Because God writes like the poets, far better, of course, but I mean, He writes like the poets in the sense that He's crafting this for you to see the way He wants you to see it and in the timing that He wants you to see it. I mentioned to you about C.S. Lewis and the idea of submitting yourself to an artwork. The first thing you're required to do is to submit. Well, that's what I mean. I want you to be able to stick with a piece of work long enough that you can get what He's actually telling you. And if you're like me, you don't want to stick to it that long. I want to get on to the bottom line. I want to get to where I see the point and I can make a note, I can underline it in my Bible, and I can get on to the next bit. Because we learn that quantity and speed are somehow good. And they're not. So what I want to do in this hour, we have until quarter till, don't we? What I want to do is I want to show you two bits of writing. One from perhaps the greatest English writer we've got, William Shakespeare. And then another from the Word itself, God's Word, from the author is God. And I want to walk you through these two. I'm going to put them up here on the screen in a minute. And I'm going to walk you through them. And what I'm interested in doing is testing, in a sense, our patience and our ability to imagine those two things. And then this is going to build to my next lecture, the one tonight, where I'm going to play you a piece of music that does the same things that these two bits of writing do. You with me so far? Does it make sense? Okay, let me, I've got to read them out. These are both meant to be read aloud. So I'm going to put them up here so you can see them, but I'm also going to read them to you. See if I can get this to work. Okay, do you all know the story of Hamlet? Are you all pretty familiar with Hamlet? Hamlet, you know, in the very first, the famous soliloquy is to be or not to be, but this is a different one I'm going to show you. This is his first soliloquy. What's a soliloquy? Do you know what a soliloquy is? Anybody know? Yeah? Sorry again? Yes, a conversation with himself. Everyone else has left the stage. He's now all alone, and he's, in a sense, thinking out loud. And this is his first one. Now, you know enough about the show that we've just met him in this first scene. This is Act 1, Scene 2. In the first scene, the guards on the battlement have run into this ghost of Hamlet's father, and he says nothing. But they're concerned enough to say, I know that this ghost who won't talk to us, maybe will talk to Hamlet. We're going to bring Hamlet up here. So they're about to go to him and say, Hamlet, you aren't going to believe this, but we saw your dad last night. Okay, but before they come, we have a scene, this scene, and Hamlet's mother, Gertrude, has just married Hamlet's uncle after his father has died, almost immediately. And this is a great weight to Hamlet. And he doesn't know yet that there's been any murder going on, but he's certainly not happy about the way things have gone. So let me read you this speech. This is what he says. After Gertrude and his uncle have left, and all the people have left, and he's on the stage by himself, he says this. Oh, that this too solid flesh would melt, thaw, and resolve itself into a dew. Or that the everlasting had not fixed his cannon against self-slaughter. Oh, God. God, how weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable seem to me all the uses of this world. Fie on it. Ah, fie, 'tis an unweeded garden that grows to seed. Things rank and gross in nature possess it merely. That it should come to this. Not 2 months dead. Nay, not so much, not two. So excellent a king that was to this Hyperion, to a scatter. So loving to my mother that he might not detain the winds of heaven visit her face too roughly. Heaven and earth must I remember. But she would hang on him as if increase of appetite had grown by what it fed on. And yet, within a month, let me not think on it, frailty, thy name is woman. A little month, or ere those shoes were old with which she followed my poor father's body like Niobe, all tears, by she, even she, oh, God, a beast that wants discourse of reason would have mourned longer. Married with my uncle, my father's brother, but no more like my father than I for Hercules. Within a month, ere yet the salt of most unrighteous tears had left the fucking of her gullet eyes, she married. Most wicked speed to post with such dexterity to incestuous cheats. It is not or cannot come to good, but break my heart, for I must hold my tongue. And that's the speech. Now, da-da-da. It's quite a speech, isn't it? Now, the question I want to ask you is this. Where do you get in that speech the essence of it? Where is the key word or phrase that is the point of this speech? Can you imagine? Anybody got ideas? I know it's in two pages, so maybe I'll have to go back and forth between them. You can see. What is he saying? What's his main point? You really want to give it a try? Yeah. Bravo, bravo. Married with my uncle, my father's brother. I think that's it too. It's exactly right. He says, I am so ticked off that my mother has married my father, or my uncle rather, so quickly after my father's death. I wish they had never gotten married. No, that can't be it. It must be uncle. That's it. Right. He says, right, married with my uncle. Right about in the middle there. Married with my uncle, my father's brother. I think that's it. Thank you. That's real good. Now, here's my question to you. Why did Shakespeare write it like that? Why didn't he just have Hamlet come out and go, kicked off with my mother for marrying my uncle right after so much of my father's funeral. Why is this? Is this better?
I hope so. I hope so. Yes. Yeah.
That's better. That's better, right? Than this. Than what I just did. Why is that better? Why would he write it like that? Why would he start off so? I mean, that's 3/4 of the way through the piece, right? Why would he put off the point for so long? Look at what he writes first. What's he say first? Oh, that this two solid flesh would melt, fall, resolve itself into a dew. What's he talking about? What flesh is he talking about? What flesh? That this two solid flesh. His heart. I thought I heard somebody say it. Yeah, his heart. Thank you, Grace. It was great for them. Ah, these are my students back here, you see. His heart. His heart is hard. Have you ever felt you're so upset about something that's happened? You're just cold inside. You're just frustrated and angry and depressed altogether. Well, there he is. Oh, that my heart would melt, fall, and resolve. That I could go, this is okay. Everything's going to be fine. I can't do it, you see. Or, if I can't get my heart to resolve, fall and resolve, what? Why? And I can't commit suicide, he says. Why can't I? It's against God's law. The capital E, everlasting, that's God. Or that God had not fixed his canon, his law, against suicide. Okay, so now I'm stuck, he says. Oh, that this two solid flesh would melt, fall, and resolve itself to a dew, or that I could kill myself, then it would be better. Then he gives us a metaphor. He talks about how he feels first, and then he gives us a metaphor. What does he say? Oh, God. God, how weary, pale, flat, and unprofitable seem to me all the uses of this world. Have you ever felt like that? Have you ever looked at the world and feel so discouraged, so even depressed? You look at the world and it just seems weary, stale, flat, and dark, and unprofitable. Nothing good comes of it. That's a great picture of depression, I think. Imagine that. Then he says his metaphor. He says, 'tis an unweeded garden that grows the seed. What's the unweeded garden? The church? He hasn't mentioned the church, has he? No, not the church. It's going to be something in here. The world, that he has mentioned, hasn't he? Right. How weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable seem to me all the uses of this world. 'Tis an unweeded garden. That's the world. You know what an unweeded garden looks like, right? Grows to seed, things rank and gross. And what's rank mean? Stinks. Smells bad. Things that are rank. And gross in nature. What is gross in nature? What do you think? Sorry, polluted? Well, kind of. Misshapen, that's exactly right, yeah. Overgrown. Gross means large, over large. So if something's gross in nature, it's like a giant. You expected a well-proportioned plant, and it's somehow overgrown and gotten all connected to everything else. I have a vine like that at my house. It's gone mad. Wrapped its way through fences and things, and gone up into trees. And got to go out there and beat it back with a club. You can see I'm not a gardener. okay, so he says how weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable are all the uses of this world. The world is an unweeded garden. That's how it seems to me. Things rank and gross in nature possess the garden, the world. That it should come to this, not 2 months dead. Nay, not so much, not two. What? He hasn't said yet. That it should, he's just thinking to himself, right? He knows. But he hasn't said it to you yet. He hasn't said it out loud yet. That it should come to this, not 2 months dead. Nay, not so much, not two. So excellent a king as was to this Hyperion to a satyr. This is Hyperion, you know? Huh? Yes, he was. That's right. Do you remember what he does every day? He's the chariot driver that pulls the sun across the sky. He is connected to the... Have you ever seen the Parthenon? The facade of the Parthenon? Just went out of my head. Pediment. In that pediment of the Parthenon, that triangular shape in the front of the Parthenon, you see Hyperion with a horse in front of him coming up out of the water. And you know the sun is coming up behind him because he pulls the sun through the sky and through the pediment and disappears into the water at the other side, at the end of the day. So Hyperion is this titan who is related to the sun. The greatness and the light and the warmth and the health from the sun is all about Hyperion, right? So what's a satyr? Do you know what a satyr is? Yeah? Yes! It's a half-human, half-goat creature. And he's kind of a miserable creature. In Greek mythology, he was a kind of lust-filled creature, half animal, that sort of chased nymphs through the woods all the time, you know? Kind of a gross little guy. Nobody liked him. You know Mr. Tumnus? You know who he is, right? Well, Mr. Tumnus is a satyr, but C.S. Lewis kind of cleaned him up a little bit. But you notice that he is a betrayer in there. You remember? He betrays the little children. So he carries some of his characteristics still. But a satyr is a really disgusting creature in Greek mythology. So here he is comparing his father to Hyperion and his uncle to a satyr. Blech. Well, he didn't say that, but I that's my interpretation. So now my question is, why is he saying all this stuff? Why does he tell us about how his heart is hard? Why does he tell us about how weary, stale, and flat everything is? Why does he tell us about the relationship between his father and his uncle? Why does he tell us about the next bit? So excellent a king as was to this Hyperion to a satyr. Then he says, that king, that Hyperion, my father, was so loving to my mother that he might not deem the winds of heaven visit her face too roughly. What could be more gentle than the winds of heaven? Oh no, you winds of heaven, don't visit my wife's face too roughly. That's what he's saying. The gentlest winds in the whole universe, beyond the universe even. But he cared so much about her, he protected her from even those little ruffles, you see. And she would hang on him as if increase of appetite had grown by what it fed on. When you have an appetite, and you fill it, and you're hungry, and you eat, the appetite goes away, doesn't it? But in this case, her appetite, his mother's appetite for his father, seemed to increase the more they were together. She just couldn't get enough of him, in other words. It's a beautiful picture of their marriage, of their relationship. He protecting her, she hanging on him. The two of them were so close. And yet, within a month, you see now why within a month becomes a powerful statement? Because he's laid out for you a framework of Hamlet's mind and his heart. How it is that he feels, how it is he looks at the world, how it is that he views this relationship between his uncle and his mother. How horrible it is to him. So that when he finally does get to his point, married with my uncle, you feel the weight of it. If he had just come on and said, I'm really mad because my mom married my uncle and walked off, you could have checked it off. You could have said, well, I get that. I know he didn't want ice cream. You know, he didn't want to take flying lessons. There are a lot of things he's not saying. But, this is to give you the weight of it. This is to get you into Hamlet's mind and heart. You see? Now, watch what happens. He's got that in mind. Shakespeare, when he's writing it, has it in mind that the point is this, married with my uncle. But he doesn't put it within the first half of the speech. He puts it halfway through the second half of the speech. And look what happens just before he gets there. Oh, and one last thing before I turn the slide. Do you see how he says to begin with that it should come to this, but 2 months dead? At first he thinks it's been 2 months, and that's a short time, he thinks. Just 2 months. And then he says, well, hang on, no, that's not right. It hasn't even been 2 months. And then look at the bottom here. When he gets more involved with it and thinks about it more, he says, within a month. It hasn't even been 1 month. Then he says this, let me not think on it, frailty, my name is woman. Women are frail. A little month. It's only a little month now, see? Or yet those shoes were old with which she followed my poor father. Why would she be following the poor father's body? Funeral. The funeral procession, they're taking the casket out of the church and she's following along like the widow that she is. Ere those shoes were old, those shoes had only been that long used, with which she followed my poor father like Niobe, another classical reference to Niobe weeping for her children, right? Unconsolable weeping by Niobe. She's the poster child for, you know, uncontrolled weeping. So here he says, she was walking along behind father's casket, weeping uncontrollably, like Niobe. And then look at the way he writes it. He says, why she, see that? That's in the original, that dash dash. Oh God, a beast that wants this course of reason would have mourned longer, dash dash, married with my uncle. You remember? The point is, married with my uncle. He's put it off until finally he's going to say, here's the line, why she, even she, married with my uncle. That's the line. But he interjects this exclamation. So he gets right barely up to finally pulling the trigger on what it is he wants to say in this speech. And when he gets there, he puts it off one more second. Do you see how you have to have patience? Do you see how you have to let the man talk in the way he wants to talk? What does it mean? Oh God, a beast that wants this course of reason would have mourned longer. What does that mean? Exactly. Even an animal that doesn't have the ability to think, it wants the discourse of reason, would have mourned longer for its mate, then my mother mourned for my father. How can this be? You see the exasperation, the desperation? So you have to read it that way. You have to read it like he's about to say, why she, even she, married with my uncle. But you have to say, why she, even she, oh God, a beast that wants this course of reason would have mourned longer. Married. With my uncle. He completes the thought. See? Did you have a question?
Calling his mother names?
No.
He's not doing that. No, he's saying, you can see how he thinks that a beast would be better than she is. I guess if that's calling her a name, then yeah, you could say that. He's not saying she's a beast, though. He's just saying that she's sickle. Frailty by name is woman! So that's how the speech goes, see? That's how it goes. Now, I would say that's pretty darn sharp writing. Do you see why? Because it lays the framework for what it is he wants to say. He engages you in it first, and then it draws you to a conclusion and puts it off and puts it off and puts it off until you're ready to hear it. And when you're finally ready to hear it, he pulls the trigger, and then you get the point of the speech, and all the rest of it then, you know, kind of falls in behind it. So it's a dramatic moment because of all that. That's good writing. Let me show you something else. Let me show you chapter 28 of Job. You probably all know this. And this needs to be read aloud as well, so track along with me, huh? Surely there is a mine for silver and a place where they refine gold. Iron is taken from the dust and copper is smelted from rock. Man puts an end to darkness and in the farthest limit he searches out the rock in gloom and dark, deep shadow. He sinks a shaft far from habitation, forgotten by the foot. They hang and swing to and fro far from men. The earth from it comes food, and underneath it is turned up as fire. Its rocks are the source of sapphires, and its dust contains gold. The path no bird of prey knows, nor has the falcon's eye caught sight of it. The proud beasts have not trodden it, nor has the fierce lion passed over it. He, man, puts his hand on the flint. He overturns the mountains at the base. He hews out channels through the rocks, and his eye sees anything precious. He dams up the streams from flowing, and what is hidden he brings out to the light. But where can wisdom be found? And where is the place of understanding? Man does not know its value, nor is it found in the land of the living. The deep says, "It's not in me." The sea says, "It's not with me." Pure gold cannot be given in exchange for it, nor can silver be weighed as its price. It can't be valued in the gold of Ophir, in precious onyx or sapphire. Gold or glass cannot equal it, nor can it be exchanged for articles of fine gold. Coral and crystal are not to be mentioned, and the acquisition of wisdom is above that of pearls. The topaz of Ethiopia cannot equal it, nor can it be valued in pure gold. Where then does wisdom come from? And where is the place of understanding? Thus it is hidden from the eyes of all living and concealed from the birds of the sky. Abaddon and Death say, "With our ears we have heard a report of it." God understands its way, and he knows its place, for he looks to the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. When he imparted weight to the wind, and he meted out waters by measure, when he set a limit to the rain and a course for the thunderbolt, then he saw it and declared it and established it and searched it out. And he said to man, he said, "Behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding." Now, let me ask you the same question. Can you tell me where to find the one line, say, one phrase, that is the key to this chapter? Verse 28. Whoops, wrong way. Verse 28, and he said to man, "Behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And to avoid evil is understanding." Is that what you'd say? Would everybody agree? Yeah, I agree. So then why can't I do the same thing with this as I did with Hamlet? Why can't I say, why didn't God write that? What's all that other stuff that comes before it? Why didn't he write Job 28, verse 1, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. Job 29. Why not? Why is this somehow better? If we're willing to grant that Shakespeare had a reason for doing it the way he did, how much more should we grant that God had a reason? So the question is, why did he say it like this? What is the form? What has the form got to do with the content? Let's go back to the beginning. What does he say first? What's he talking about first? Man's accomplishment? What kind of accomplishment? I agree, but what kind of accomplishment? Mining, yeah. Surely there's a mine. Iron is taken from the dust. Man puts an end to darkness. He needs to make fire. He can light up things that are dark, like underground, so he can mine. Okay. I love the line. Look in verse 4. He sinks a shaft far from habitation, forgotten by the foot, hanging to and fro, swaying. Can't you just see a guy way down in a mine somewhere on a rope, hanging and chipping away at the rock? No bird of prey can know where he is. No falcon's eye has ever caught sight of it. The proud beasts haven't trodden on it. He sinks these shafts into the ground, digging through solid rock to get to wealth, get to these beautiful and precious things. So why does he start there? Why is that the first thing God tells us? Right, right. He's seeking for something valuable. Man is. In fact, not just seeking, but like pursuing with every square inch of his being, right? I mean, look, what would it take you to run a shaft into the ground deep enough to be able to dig gold out? I mean, you got to be pretty committed, right? You got to find tools. You got to strain every muscle. You got to work pretty hard. I think he's starting where we are, where our hearts are. Our hearts are, even now, metaphorically, thinking about how I'm going to make a living, how I'm going to pay for my life, how I'm going to raise my kids when I'm married, you know, whatever. I've got to make a living. So here I am, focused on the mine, digging away, working. And God comes along and says, surely there's a mine for silver. there ever. See? He's got my number. He knows exactly where my heart is. And he's saying, man really worked hard to get all that stuff, doesn't he? And I go, you betcha. Let me show you the muscles. I am really having to do a workout here, and I'm sweating and straining. And he says, you go so far down into the ground, even the animals don't know where you are. That's right, man. Digging away. See? Then he says, well, where can wisdom be found? And I go, well, I'll dig for it, see? I know about digging. He's got to be here somewhere. What does he say next? He says, can't dig for it. See that? Am I? Yeah, next one. He says, you can't, verse 12 says, where can wisdom be found? Man doesn't know its value. Man doesn't even pay attention to it properly. He's digging for gold. He's not looking for wisdom. But my first thought is, once he gets my attention and says, well, can you find wisdom? Yeah, well, I'll just dig for it. And he says, well, you can't dig for it. He says, it's not found in the land of the living, verse 13. The deep says it's not in me. The sea says it's not in me. I'm literally digging into the deep trying to figure out where it is, right? Oh, well, wisdom. Yeah, why was I thinking that? We're stupid. You can't dig for wisdom. Okay, sure, right. Well, how can I get wisdom? I know. I will buy it with what I dug out of the ground. So the next thing he does is he says, pure gold can't be given in exchange for it. Oh, really? You can't buy it with onyx. You can't buy it with sapphires or gold and glass. You can't exchange it for fine gold. Coral and crystal. You didn't even mention coral and crystal. It's better than pearls.
the topaz of Ethiopia can't buy. Look, if the topaz of Ethiopia can't buy wisdom, I mean, come on. So now he's got my attention. See what I was doing first? I was thinking only in terms of how I'm going to make my living. And he says, what about wisdom? Oh, yeah, wisdom. Well, I'll dig for it. No, you can't get it there. Of course, you can't get it there. Sure, okay. I'll buy it. He says, well, you can't buy it with even all the topaz of Ethiopia. Huh, I say. Okay, you got me. Where does wisdom come from? See, I'm down to the point where he says, at the very bar 20, verse 20, you're a musician. Where does wisdom come from? That's the second time he's asked, right? Verse 12, where can wisdom be found? Where then does wisdom come from? Now I'm a little bit curious. Excuse me. So I say, okay, you got my attention. Where does wisdom come from? Look what he says. Does he tell me then? Is the next verse, the fear of the Lord, is that wisdom? No, it's not. He says, it's hidden from everybody. You can't even get it at death. Well, hang on. What? So you remember I started digging, right? And then I stopped digging when I realized I couldn't get it there. And I listened to him tell me I can't buy it, what I've dug. And now I'm interested. See, where can I get wisdom? And he says, you can't even get it by dying. The living doesn't know about it. It's not in the sea. It's not in the land. And death, he's only heard of a report of it. Death even can't give it to you. Okay, now you got me. Okay, what is this you're talking about? What is this wisdom? And you know what he says? No, I'm not telling you yet. Why not? I'm putting it off because you're not ready. What do I need to hear? God knows where wisdom is. Face palm. Duh. I should have thought of that. God knows what. Of course. All right, God. Lay it on me. Give me the wisdom. You know what he says? He says, no. You're not ready yet. What does he tell me next? God knows its way. He understands its place. What does he tell me next? What do I need to hear before I can get the wisdom? What's that? Who God is. He's the guy who sets the course for the thunderbolt. He's the guy who meets out the waters of the world. He says you can have this much water and no more. Pretty powerful God. He's the guy who imparts weight to the wind, sets the limit for rain. Now, I've been looking to God. I said, okay, lay it on me, God. Tell me the truth about all this. And he says, you're not ready yet. You need to know who this God is. And he's a lot bigger than you think. And now, I'm on my knees in awe of this God. Remember how I started? I started without paying any attention to wisdom at all, right? Well, that's not going to work. Oh, this is going to work. He's turned me all the way around so that now I'm looking to God. And he's not willing to tell me yet. He needs me to be in awe of this God. So now I'm looking to God, and I'm on my knees in humility before this God. I'm nowhere near as big as you are. Please, Lord, please give me this wisdom. And now you get the wisdom. But this is the best thing of all. Check this out. What he says is, behold the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding. That's the didactic statement. That when I read this chapter, I probably read this chapter four or five times in the course of my Christian life, just reading through Job at various times, and I probably skimmed over everything, and then I got down to that last verse, and I underlined that, you know? That's what I would do. That's what people do. But check this out. This blew my mind when I started thinking about it. Here I am asking him. He says, you need to be in awe before God. So let me tell you about God. He's this, he's this, he's this. And now I'm on my knees. And then he says this. He says, you see that position you're in, Hodges? And I say, yeah. He says, that's wisdom.
Because what he says here is the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. The fear of the Lord, the awe before God. That's what wisdom is. Do you see how the poetry of those first 27 verses changed my heart? It took me from looking this way all the way around to participating in the wisdom before he told me verse 28. That's genius. Shakespeare could only aspire to write like that. This is the power of the Holy Spirit that takes your heart and changes it as you read. This is what the Word does. This is why we read the Word. This is what's going on. It's not just to know head knowledge. It's not just to get the bottom line underlined. It's to let the Word in its own tempo, as it were, as in its own speed, speak to us in a way that will change us to be more like Him. That's the goal. And that's what that passage does. And I must have read it 5-6 times before I ever gave it that close of a reading. Does that make sense? Do you see that? I wish our people could write that well. I wish Shakespeare would have wished to be able to move the hearts of his people in the way that this does. But that's what it does if you allow it to. So, the two things we have to have in order to be able to make sense of the Word of God, but then by extension, any other art form, any other expression, that's obviously not the Word of God, but still a human expression, we want to really understand what's going on. We need to have an imagination. We need to be able to get into the mind of the person that's speaking and what kinds of things he's going through. We have to be able to do that. We have to be able to hear Romeo say, "It is the East and Juliet is the Sun," in order to be able to grasp not only that Juliet is beautiful, but that Romeo is in love with her. That's what we're getting. We're getting a vision of Romeo's heart when he says, "Juliet is the Sun." We don't just get a picture of Juliet, we get a picture of Romeo. All of that requires an imagination. And God has given us an imagination to be able to do just that. And then secondly, we have to have patience. And we have to work at this triply hard, folks. We have to be willing to allow the Scripture, especially, but any other art form, to speak to us in its own timing, in its own way. You remember the quote I gave you from T.S. Eliot? You mean you want me to say it worse? Here's Eliot, who has crafted this piece of work, and he thinks, this is the way to say this. There isn't any better way to say this. If I have to summarize it, I do it in injustice. Okay, that's my talk. Can I give you one? I've got 5 minutes. Can I use my 5 minutes? Is that right? Can I give you one other aspect of Chartres Cathedral that I like? Okay. There is a... told you that it's in the shape of a cross, right? And that the north end of the building is in indirect light, the south end is in direct light. At the west end of the building is the foot of the cross, right? East end is the head of the cross, the foot of the cross is at the west end. So, and the west end is the main portal, that's where you come in and out. Well, the east end of the building has statuary and windows that deal with the creation, because that's where the sun rises in the beginning of every day. The first light of the day hits the east end of the building, and the east end then speaks of the creation and of the first two chapters of Genesis. As you go through the day, the sun is on the south side of the building, so the north side has indirect light. That's where the Old Testament figures are, for the most part. And on the south side, you have the New Testament figures in direct light. So far, so good. The last light of the day falls on the foot of the cross. And so you might imagine that at the foot of the cross, above the, what they call the tympani, above the door, there's three portals, are statues about Jesus enthroned in heaven in judgment. So it's the end of the Bible, you see? So the building actually tells every day, in a sense, tells the whole story of the Bible, if you just read it that way. So when you come to the foot of the cross, you go into the middle door, and you look up, and above you is Jesus enthroned, and he has got the sheep on his right and the goats on his left, and he's deciding whose name is in the book of life. So, every time that you come to worship, you come to the foot of the cross. It's on purpose. And you come under the judgment of Christ. Isn't that interesting? Literally come under it. You want to walk under it. That's amazing to me. I wish we would build our churches so that they would speak this way to us, you know? On the right side of the three portals as you enter at the foot of the cross, on the right side, the tympanum above that, is Jesus in Mary's lap. You know Roman Catholicism, you know that Mary is the Queen of Heaven and she's crowned, and so a lot of times we'll have Mary there with Jesus in her lap, judging. But nevertheless, around her and him are these angels, and these angels are clearly worshiping Jesus. But beyond them, on the outside of the little tympanum, are a bunch of figures that don't have wings. And if you look at them more carefully, you see that they're figures that are little men working. They've got little desks in their laps, and they're working. And each of them is different. And they're interspersed with women. And the women are tall and graceful in a kind of flowing robe, and they are embodying something. You know how, like, you have a Statue of Liberty kind of embodies liberty? Kind of anthropomorphism. That's right, thank you. You know, she's representing liberty. She's not just a human being, she's actually representing that concept. Well, that's how it is around the outside of this tympanum. There are these women, and the woman is representing one of the seven liberal arts. Do you know the liberal arts? Some of you have been taught classical education, right? Anybody know what the seven liberal arts are? I can't count that high. Musicians only have to count the four. Right. There's the trivium and there's the quadrivium. The trivium is, anybody know? Grammar, logic, rhetoric. Very good. Grammar, logic, rhetoric. And the quadrivium is arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and music is right. Somebody got it. Yeah, that's right. Arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and music. The trivium is about language. The quadrivium is about numbers. And the combination of the two was the Greek and then eventually the revived medieval and early church mindset about what education was supposed to be all about. Because revelation comes in two forms. It comes in written word, and it comes in the general world, the created world. The written word needs to be studied for language. The creation, the general revelation, needs to be studied by numbers. Words and numbers. Reading, Latin, and arithmetic. That's where it comes from. Those two things. Okay, so here they are, these seven liberal arts, and in between them is a little statue of a man, and it's a little man that's representing that art as well. So you have on the lower left-hand corner, you have a statue of logic, and below logic is Aristotle working, and above them is rhetoric and Cicero, and then geometry and Euclid. And then on the other side, you have arithmetic and Boethius, and astronomy and Ptolemy, and then grammar and Donatus, the Roman grammarian. And then you have music and Pythagoras. Pythagoras is the one who kind of got an idea of all the overtone theories, for those of you who are interested. Oh, okay, so all seven of these liberal arts, you see, are right there. But not a one of them is a Christian. But they represent the old world wisdom, you see. Because there was a school at Chartres. They called it the Chartres Cathedral School. And it was one of many. And that Chartres Cathedral School taught the seven liberal arts. And so they established that not only do the angels worship God, but all of knowledge worships God. All of the world worships God. Everything that exists is His, you see. And that inspired the curriculum for the University of Paris in about 1200. And the University of Paris inspired the University of Oxford, Oxford University, and Oxford inspired Cambridge. And people from Cambridge, Christians who graduated from Cambridge in the 17th century, got on a boat and came across to the United States, and they founded their first university there, named after their leader, a guy called John Harvard, and it was based on that same curriculum that they got from Cambridge. And Harvard inspired Yale, and Yale, Princeton, and so on and so on, and all across this country. You could actually argue that the fact that we're sitting in this room right now studying these things is the result, partly anyway, of the work those guys did at Chartres to inspire Paris, Oxford, Cambridge, Harvard, and the New World. It's all connected up. Okay. Well, I'll see you this evening for a little talk through some music. Thanks, everybody.